This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello, very good morning to you. Hilary Swank is one of our guests this morning. She is part of a very exciting, I have to say, very involving new Netflix series about a trip to Mars. It's called Away. And Hilary Swank will chat about that in a moment or two. One in four women we know will lose a baby during pregnancy or birth. What was it like to have a miscarriage during lockdown? There were new rules brought in to minimise patient contact to protect pregnant women and staff. But what was that experience like? Not easy, to put it mildly. We'll discuss that on Woman's Hour today as well. And we'll also celebrate a new anthology of writing by British Muslim women. It's called, got it here with me, A Match Made in Heaven. And we'll hear from one of the writers on Woman's Hour this morning. Let's start then, journeying to Mars in the company of the Oscar-winning actress Hilary Swank, star of Boys Don't Cry and Million Dollar Baby. She's going to Mars, and it's quite a long trip, in the new Netflix series Away. Now, she plays Commander Emma Green, who leaves her husband and daughter behind to lead an international crew of astronauts on that perilous 3-year mission to the Red Planet. Here she is, talking to her daughter on Earth.
It's time for decompression, Commander.
Copy.
I gotta go, sweetie.
Okay.
You're my reason.
My reason to hold on tight.
I love you, Lex.
I love you too, Mom.
I'll talk to you soon.
Well, dramatic stuff. I have to say, perhaps that doesn't give the fairest illustration of this show. It's not as schmaltzy as that sounds. Here is Hilary.
First of all, I wanted to be an astronaut before I wanted to be an actor. So it's kind of fun to scratch the surface there. I got to speak to some incredible astronauts who are the best in their field, which is such a great thing as an actor. Like when you dive into these other worlds, you get to speak to the people at the top and pick their brains. And it reminded me of why I wanted to be an astronaut at 6 years old, which is just the idea of something bigger than us, the idea of the unknown. And I think that a mission to Mars is well within our lifetime. And I just think that that's incredible. When you hear them talk about looking back down at Earth and there's no borders up there, and the idea that we're all on this Earth together, we're all one people in a way. It doesn't matter if you're Russian or you're British or you're American or you're Chinese or Indian, in the case of the astronauts on this spaceship. And that's what I love so much, is we represent all the different colors of what you see when you walk around in daily life. And that's not usually depicted on the screen.
No, it isn't. But I guess the pandemic has also made that a reality. Whether we like it or not, we are all in this parlous state together at the moment, aren't we?
Yes, exactly. In the end, we're all humans. We're trying to figure out what our purpose is. Give and receive love. Have no regrets. When you strip down the stereotypes, you know, that's what's underneath all of us. That's the humanity that connects us all.
I've been fortunate enough to interview a couple of astronauts, including Britain's first astronaut, who's a woman called Helen Sharman. And they are just an extraordinary brand of human being, aren't they? And they're incredibly humble.
Yes, their brain is remarkable. That's when I knew I couldn't be an astronaut. I don't have that brain. It's out of this world. Sorry, bad pun. I spoke to Jessica Meir when she was on the ISS, the International Space Station. She was up there for 7 months. And then subsequently, I spoke to her when she touched down. And she said she felt like she was landing on a foreign planet because she touched down during the coronavirus. Yeah. They had to touch down in Kazakhstan and quarantine for like 4 weeks because your immune system is very different after coming back from space. But she just said it's when you touch back down, you don't realize that you take for granted what you're smelling. The smell of the earth is so distinct and beautiful. And then you hear the sound of the wind ruffling through the leaves. And she just said she just is in awe when she touched back down at the, what we take for granted.
You are the commander of this spaceship in this new show, and that brings with it its own challenging dynamic for you. But you're also a character who's facing 3 years away from your partner and child, and that would seem to anybody a quite colossal undertaking. Do you think humans are going to be prepared for something like that and be willing to do it?
Oh, 100%. You see, a lot of the show is about this mission to Mars and the dream of that, but also this gravitational pull to Earth and the love of family and the sacrifices that we make for both. And that it's a daily choice. When do you choose your career? When do you choose your family? And that's also something I think so many people can relate to right now, especially so many more women are in the workplace, thankfully, doing what they want to be doing. And or as we find equality across the board. And as you say, you know, this is a woman leading a mission to Mars, but that's not the drama of the story, which I think is also exciting. You know, 5 years ago, that would have been the drama itself. Her husband would have been emasculated and would have been upset. He wasn't going, but instead that the drama evolves around other things, which I think is super exciting.
If you look back over your career, what are you most proud of? A lot of our listeners, I think, will have invested in Boys Don't Cry, for example, for which you won an Oscar. Now, that is a very significant film to a lot of people. You play a trans man and a real person as well. And this is a film that a lot of people really care about, Hilary, still.
Yeah, you kind of just teed up my answer because you're right. And that would be for certain, I think, the film that I will always be the most proud of being a part of and telling. It's a story that started an important conversation about really a group of marginalized people that weren't even accepted by the gay and lesbian community at that time. I think had I looked back and seen the impact that it made, the responsibility on my shoulders might have made me been overwhelming. So, but yeah, that still needs to continue to be talked about. We're still not even close to where we need to be in that community and the acceptance. So long way to go.
You're often regarded as quite a singular person because you're obviously hugely successful, but you're not that show busy a showbiz person, are you? You've got your pets. You've got this incredibly... I was actually a bit disappointed. The parrot doesn't seem to be with you, but you've got a talking parrot. I mean, haven't we all? But this one can interrupt interviews, we're told.
Yeah, it's just so early, so I'm not down there with them right now. I actually rescued another one about a year and a half ago, and they're so funny. You know, we take a lot of road trips.
You and your husband and the parrots?
Yeah, and the dogs. We don't have the means to fly around in private jets like some other people in the business. So we drive, and so that we can take all our pack. But we also love a road trip anyway. We spend a lot of time in Colorado, so we drive back and forth from California to Colorado. And about a year and a half ago, we found another dog pregnant on the side of the road, and we helped her deliver her babies. We raised them. Well, really, I did. Then raised them until they were about 12 weeks old, and found them homes. And so I just love animals. You know, they don't judge people. They see you, they just kind of really see you, and they're the best. I have a couple of horses as well, and there's just no happier place for me. I'm right now sitting on 168 acres in Colorado, and I'm so blessed to be able to have this land and this place to kind of get away from everything and recharge.
Well, it could be a lot worse, couldn't it? A lot of our listeners, and a topic that comes up time and time again on our kind of program, is the subject of caring. And you are someone who took time out to look after your dad when he was not at all well. How important was that period of your life for you?
It was so important. I just said, yes, this is what you do. My dad is in the greatest need of his life. They gave him approximately 3 years to live. And if he didn't get a lung transplant, and it was a no-brainer, he didn't have anyone in his life. Becoming his health advocate was, of course, what I was going to do. My dad is super fun to be around. My grandmother's from Devon. He's got that great British humility and sense of humor. He's very witty, but the hard part was the ups and downs, you know, the struggle and his fight for life. I'm so glad that I was able to be by his side. You know, what a blessing that I have a job that I can walk away from and have the means to live and be there for him. It was supposed to take 1 year because it takes a year to see if an organ takes. But he was having so many complications. It took about three. He still lives with us in California, which is so wonderful. Probably not for him. I think he would like to get back to, you know, where he was living in Iowa and the such, but there's a lot of things, which I'm sure I'm boring you with now, but there's like spores and things in certain areas that affect your lungs. And if a doctor looks at your lungs, they can tell you where you're from approximately. Wow. Due to the condition of them inside. Isn't that crazy?
Right. I must admit, I didn't know about your British heritage. Have you never played anybody British?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's disgraceful.
It is disgraceful. Well, we got to change that. Let's put that out there.
Well, we have.
Devon is so beautiful too.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, you know that business about the Devon cream tea?
Yeah.
So is it jam first or cream or what? What do you go for?
You put your cream in before your tea, don't you?
No,
that's
a cup of tea. I'm talking about a scone.
No, I know, but I'm starting with that.
Okay.
Do you put your cream in first?
No, with a cup of tea, I'm afraid I lop the cream in last, the milk or whatever. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, so do I. So we're in the same. Then I put my clotted cream on first, but I put it last in my tea. But I put it on first because it doesn't stay well over the jam.
Right.
It kind of falls off. So you need the jam to sit on top of it.
That is the Swank way to do a Devon cream tea. That's Hilary Swank. Turns out to be a little bit British. And she did say that she would love to play a British woman. So if you're out there, casting agents, get in touch with Hilary. That series on Netflix, Away, is available to watch from today. And if you'd like to hear the interview that we did on Woman's Hour with Helen Sharman, I think there are a few, actually, you will find those interviews on BBC Sounds. But she is a brilliant woman and, of course, Britain's first astronaut. Now, one in four women will lose a baby during pregnancy or birth. And during lockdown, obviously, maternity services carried on. But new rules, sensibly, of course, were brought in to minimise patient contact to protect pregnant women and NHS staff. But what impact did those new rules have on people, women, going through a miscarriage? Helen is from Kent, and you'll hear her experience first. She had her fourth miscarriage in March of this year.
I had the three previous miscarriages and I was under the care of St Mary's, the current miscarriage unit in London. I found out that I was pregnant just before the 23rd of March lockdown. And unfortunately, as this is something that had never been experienced before, the whole country, as we know, went into disarray. And there was no protocol in terms of what to do in a pandemic situation. The recurrent miscarriage unit actually immediately closed down due to COVID-19 restrictions. And the consultant that I'd been seeing was unfortunately having to self-isolate. So as part of the meetings I'd been having with St Mary, I'd had some vital blood tests and it was essential for me to have the results of those blood tests back. What happened next, at a time of high anxiety anyway, was every day for at least 2 weeks, I was on the phone, on email, trying to hunt down my blood test results. I was trying to understand how I could have the early pregnancy scan that under any normal circumstances I would absolutely have been entitled to. And it was, I think, only best described as chaotic. The words that I kept hearing over and over again from the people that I spoke to within the NHS were, "We're so sorry, we're so sorry, we can't help you, we don't know what to do."
But all the time you were trying to chase this down, you were having a miscarriage.
I didn't know at the time. I needed the scan to know whether or not my baby had a heartbeat.
Right. I mean, incredibly stressful. And what happened in the end?
So eventually I managed to secure a scan at Pembury Tunbridge Wells Hospital. The protocol at that point is that you can only go in on your own. I went in on my own and my partner sat outside in the car park on the tarmac. And then I had to be told on my own that my baby had no heartbeat. There were no actual external signs that there was anything wrong with the pregnancy until that point. So that was very difficult to hear. And then I had to go down and I had to speak to Dan, my partner, and give him the news that would have otherwise been delivered by a doctor just standing in the car park. And I remember a nurse, as I was going in, I asked for directions, and she asked me what I was in for, and I said, potentially, I need a scan, see if I'm going to be miscarrying. And she said to me, if only I could put my arm around you, and that really resonated.
So your treatment in this miscarriage, because unfortunately you have had others, was very different from what had happened before?
Completely different. And actually there were potential risks involved because of the impact of COVID-19. So I had to go back a couple of weeks later to have a second scan to confirm that the baby definitely was not growing. When I went to the second scan, they then give you medical treatment to speed along the miscarriage. It was what's known as a missed miscarriage, where there's no external signs, but you need to remove the products of pregnancy because of the risk of infection. The doctors at the time, as I was on my own, told me that they would recommend, after seeing the scans, that I stayed in. But I wasn't absorbing information. I was distressed. I desperately wanted to go and see my partner. And as a result of that, I was given the medication, and unwisely, I went home. I then had a horrendous experience. I went into contractions for 4 hours, projectile vomiting, blacking out. We were about to call an ambulance when the contractions finally subsided. And if I'd had somebody else there, just in a capacity to listen and absorb the information, then I most definitely would have stayed in hospital and listened to the advice that the doctors had given me.
Well, that is the experience of Helen, and our best wishes to her and thanks to her for speaking out as well. Fatma is 25. She is from Wiltshire and she has a daughter. She went through her second miscarriage during lockdown.
I found out I was pregnant on the 16th of March. I was absolutely fine. I had a bump. I started growing a bump. I had all the symptoms. I felt really sick. And I went in for my 12-week scan in May, on May the 12th, and I was obviously by myself because of COVID, so my husband wasn't allowed to come in. She was scanning me and kind of looked a bit distressed when she was scanning me, and then I got told that there wasn't actually a baby inside my sac. So I was pregnant, and I had a sac that had been growing and growing and growing, hence the bump. But there was just no baby or placenta or anything like that inside it. So obviously I started crying and everything like that. I managed to text my husband, who was sitting outside. They brought me into another room, and luckily enough, I was actually allowed for him to come in as well. She basically just told us that, unfortunately, like, stuff like this is very rare, but stuff like this does happen. And she doesn't really know why it happened. It's just something that, you know, the baby dies early on and gets absorbed into the sac. And I asked for the surgery, asked for a D&C. And the doctor kind of said to me, oh, because of COVID, they wouldn't put me to sleep under general anaesthetic. And obviously, I don't want to be awake for that. So she said, just, I've had a previous miscarriage that all came out naturally and was was absolutely fine. So she said, oh, just try, you know, pass this one naturally again. So I said, okay. So I went back home. And to be honest, I didn't really have a lot of pain. It was completely different to my first miscarriage. So I was like, do you know what? Like, as horrible as it is, I kind of felt a bit lucky because I didn't have to go through all the extreme pain and blood loss that I went through last year. And then I did a pregnancy test again 3 weeks later, which was like my checkup one, and it was still positive. So I went back in for another scan and they saw that I had a lot of pregnancy tissue left. And basically, I hadn't actually passed anything. So they gave me medical management treatment, which is they inserted some pessaries to basically soften your cervix to let everything come out. That, which I assumed had worked, I had about 9 hours at home in agony and, like, just so much blood loss and clots and, oh, it was horrible. Luckily, I was at home for that, so I was with my husband, so I wasn't alone, so it wasn't too bad. I assumed everything had passed. 3 weeks later, I stopped bleeding, sorry, after that, and I was absolutely fine. I had a little bit of cramps here and there, but nothing unusual. 3 weeks later, took another pregnancy test and it was still positive.
Fatma, in essence, your entire experience went on for weeks of discomfort, to put it mildly, pain, I'm sure, severe pain at times, and just the mess and the stress of it all.
Yeah. It was not only emotionally, like, horrible, it was also physically, you know, you think, oh, a miscarriage would be over within 2 to 3 weeks. That's what they normally say. But it just wasn't, it just didn't stop. And it was like, every time I went to the hospital, I got the bad news. I was that rare person that had everything go wrong that could go wrong.
And
you know?
But how much of that do you think was just your really unfortunate experience, and how much was down to the lockdown?
I think if it wasn't for COVID, when I asked for that operation in the first place, straight after I found out that there was no baby, I think I would have got it with the general anaesthetic, and they wouldn't have longed the process, because they kept saying because of COVID they didn't want to keep doing the surgery. I think if it wasn't for COVID, I probably would have had it done straight away.
And again, our thanks to Fatma for being willing to tell her experience of that second miscarriage in her case during lockdown. So let's bring in consultant gynaecologist Christine Akechi, who's speaking on behalf of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists. Christine, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Just to my final question there to Fatma, did she go through something that she might have gone through anyway? Or was her experience uniquely dreadful because of the lockdown and the impact of COVID?
Well, the first thing to say is that to hear the distress that Helen and Fatma went through is very difficult for me to hear and to listen to. We know that for any woman who unfortunately experiences a miscarriage or indeed any other complication in early pregnancy, such as an ectopic pregnancy, there is the physical and also the emotional impact. What we also know, in addition, is that due to the restrictions put in place during the COVID, or at the height of the COVID pandemic, to keep women, their family and staff safe, this would have added an extra layer of difficulty as experienced by the women. So Fatma mentions the restrictions to surgery. Mm. And she is indeed correct about that. And that is because, as well as the implications with the reduction in staff at the acute stage of the pandemic, also making sure that we had the facilities available for the acute need, people who were arriving very sick due to COVID, but also because of the risk of administering a general anaesthetic not only to the patient, but also to the staff in the theatre, the sensible decision was taken that we would only perform surgery where we felt the benefits outweighed the risks.
Right, just to interrupt you there, you're talking about the, it's normally referred to as a D&C.
So the terminology that we use now is an evacuation of retained products, so an ERPC, but many women will commonly know it termed a D&C.
I mean, it doesn't actually matter how you term it. It sounds brutal either way, to be perfectly honest. Anybody who's been through it will know exactly what that is like. So actually, I think speaking on behalf of by myself, I've had miscarriages. I know many of our listeners will have been through it too. It can be rather difficult to have a D&C, if we use that terminology, even in the best of circumstances. And there's no great time to have a miscarriage.
Absolutely. This is one of the things for those of us that work within early pregnancy. We're very concerned to highlight, which is the resources that is dedicated to delivering quality, safe, effective care for women who are diagnosed with a miscarriage and need a D&C, for example. Unfortunately, it tends to be, in some areas, a service that is at very much at the bottom of the ladder. And just as you have mentioned, for any woman, and indeed their partner, who unfortunately has to go through a diagnosis and then the steps to make sure that they have the correct management, it can be very difficult to access the services when they need it.
So you're effectively saying this is something of a Cinderella service?
It has been, but there are many of us that are working to highlight this issue and to improve the level of service where we can. It's also important that this is performed hand in hand with very important and vital research around early pregnancy. And finally, for women and their partners to talk about their experiences. For so long, miscarriage and ectopic pregnancies has been something of a taboo subject. Many women would not have been aware as to how frequent miscarriages occur. And I think that on an advocacy level, it's very important that women do talk about their experiences so we can see where the gaps are and work very hard to plug those gaps.
I think a really important...
improving the services that we deliver.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you, Christine, but I think a really important question would be what has been learnt during lockdown in case, unfortunately, we have to go through all this again?
I think it's a very important question, and I think it's a question that's not only pertinent to early pregnancy services, but indeed any service within the NHS.
Well, can we just focus on early pregnancy? Because obviously that's what we're talking about this morning.
Of course. Of where we've had restrictions to partners for women who have been diagnosed with a miscarriage or ectopic pregnancies, we know how difficult that is, how important it is to have an advocate, a second pair of ears, at a time when hard news and difficult news is delivered. I suspect that we probably would not find ourselves in a similar situation again. I think that we have learnt a lot about where we need to restrict services and what impact that may have on the delivery of services. Of course, where there has been a significant impact on the availability of staff, then of course that will determine the level of service that can be delivered. But I think it's very important that we hear what women are saying and we learn from that going forward. And where we can, we try not to limit the access for women and their birth partners.
Earlier in the lockdown, we had a very memorable edition of Woman's Hour when we talked to women who had indeed given birth during lockdown. And it was, in some cases, a terrifying and, let's be honest, a very lonely business for some of them. It was incredibly moving stuff, actually. I was in awe of their sheer guts. But we need to emphasise, and we emphasised then and we'll do it again now, that if you have any concerns about a pregnancy, you must seek help.
Absolutely. Many services now have restored their services to what they were almost pre this pandemic. But it's very important that women are reassured that services remain open, if at the very least by way of telephone access. And we are here waiting to see women. I also want to reassure women not to feel nervous about entering any clinical space if they are asked to do so. That for us as healthcare professionals, the infection prevention control measures are in place to keep women and staff safe. There are many ways to access information, not least from your local early pregnancy unit, but of course by the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists, or indeed the Tommy's charity. There are many ways to access information, and I would encourage women to do so.
Well, we'll put some links on our website later. Thank you very much. I'm grateful. Consultant gynaecologist Christina Ketchy, who is representing there the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists. So the Woman's Hour website, the source of so much useful information, of course, bbc.co.uk/womanshour. I'm sure you did enjoy Listener Week. That was last week, so that's all still available on BBC Sounds. At the beginning of this week, we did a bank holiday programme about the 40th anniversary of the brilliant Willie Russell play Educating Rita. I think that's one of my favourite ever editions of Woman's Hour to present. And that is on BBC Sounds as well. You can get that. There were so many great contributors and some wonderful emails from you afterwards as well, just about the sheer power of learning and how wonderful it is to go back to education. Next week on the programme, we're asking, Botox, would you? Stephanie Yeboah talks about her new book, Fatally Ever After. That's interesting. That's going to be a real talking point. And later in the week, how not to be late. Is being late a bad habit you can change? No, I haven't had Botox. I think that was the implication from next door. Rather an appalling lack of support from the production area this morning. Although, would I have? No, I won't have Botox, I've decided. Now to A Match Made in Heaven. British Muslim women write about love and desire. This is a new anthology with lots of different stories about sex and relationships, and it features the work of emerging writers who went to workshops in Leeds, in Bradford and in Glasgow. And the aim of the anthology is really very simple. It's to get beyond the stereotypes of subservient Muslim women. The editors were Nafisa Ali and Claire Chambers. And one of the writers is with us as well, Noreen Hack. Noreen, first of all, good morning to you.
Good morning.
We're going to hear a little bit of your story rearranged in a moment or two, but stay with us. We're very grateful to have you. Also, welcome to Nafisa and Claire. Good morning. How are you both?
Morning.
Very well.
Good, good. Nafisa, would you mind just starting for us? These workshops, whose idea were they?
So we worked at the University of Sheffield, and we were funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council in order to break down the range of stereotypes around Muslim women and living in patriarchal societies, and also the negativity around Muslims in general as well. So what we wanted to do was actually change these stereotypes and actually look at the range of experiences and look more towards the everyday experiences that Muslims have. The additional element to this was the love and desire side of it, and in looking at personal relationships. So that's how we started with the project.
And was the intention that these workshops would be, well, for a start, they were accessible. They're completely free.
Yes.
Did you have to have any qualifications at all to turn up?
No, I think what we were looking at was actually just trying to include more people into creative writing, but also looking at the element of diversity within creative writing. So you did have to be Muslim. That was one of the criteria that we were looking at. But also we were looking at young Muslims as well who could tell new stories. And you didn't have to have any experience. You could be a novice, you could be a budding writer, you could just even have an interest previously and, you might have left it for a while and come back to it. So no experience at all. And that was actually the benefits of it, really, because we had such a range of people within the groups that these fantastic stories came, and everybody had a different lens in which they viewed love and desire.
Yeah, no, some really interesting stuff in the anthology. Claire, probably a daft question in a way, but how did you know the appetite for these workshops was there?
I think there really is an appetite, and too often British Muslims are associated with problems. And when we think about love and desire, we think of Rotherham and grooming gangs on the male side. Or if we think about women, we tend to think of passive or repressed women. And that's not most people's experience at all. And I think what Nafisa was saying about ordinary, non-stereotypical, non-sensational experiences was something that writers were very keen to get across.
Go on.
And so in the anthology, I mean, there's such diversity, not only of the writers themselves, as Nafisa has been outlining, but in terms of there's a real, variety of in the tonal palette. So there's, greatly humorous stories, very irreverent pieces, sometimes very edgy and shocking.
Yes, well, at least one story genuinely shocked me.
Oh,
but that's a good thing. That's a good thing, isn't it? Well, that was the one about the porn, which
yes.
We'll see if we can get onto that. Let's bring in Noreen. Noreen, I want to know a little bit about how you felt when you went to the workshop. What was that like for you?
I absolutely loved the workshops, every single minute of it. I mean, my experience before that, I'd only ever been to other kind of course, And when I went to that one, it was quite negative in the sense that the teacher of the class turned around to us apropos of nothing and decided to say that Muslim women who wore the hijab were downtrodden and oppressed. And I remember sitting there, the only one with my hijab on, and all eyes were on me. And I was just so utterly shocked at that comment, which was just delivered so casually as if it was nothing. So coming to these workshops was just so, it was just like a breath of fresh air to meet other creative Muslim women who had really similar experiences and interests and were passionate about writing. It was, I remember feeling at the time, it was like being in a room full of unicorns, you know, like, but not that it was, not that the talent isn't out there, but the having access to women who were given that space and opportunity to be openly creative. And yeah, it was just an amazing thing to witness and experience and be part of. And, you know, they were hosted in Glasgow Women's Library, which is a fantastic place. It's just so kind of welcoming and open. And And the really good thing is that the workshops have actually continued there, specifically on playwriting, so in conjunction with Stella Quine's Theatre Company. So I've actually just finished writing a play which will be read at Glasgow Women's Library, hopefully February of next year.
So this has had a real impact on, well, your interest in work, and your ideas have been sparked by the workshop, and you feel more confident, clearly.
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, you know, the workshop's finished in 2018. And since then, I have written flash fiction, short fiction. I've started writing my own novel. Just, I don't think I would have considered these things possible before.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, can we hear a little bit of your short story, Rearranged?
Yes, of course,
set it up for us. It's about a woman whose husband has died.
That's right. So she's an older woman, she has realised that she's been in this unhappy marriage, and she feels like she's never really lived. And now she's finally free to make a fresh start and choose her own ideal husband. So the story catalogues her experience on a matrimonial website and going online and meeting people and the disasters that she faces on this kind of journey to self-discovery, her search for happiness. And it's about her love of life and poetry as well.
OK, well, can we just hear a little extract from it?
Yes, sure. She had been married to Gazumfer for over 3 decades. It had been 30 years of bland indifference. Even on the day she accepted his proposal, she had suspected she would one day find herself telling the story of their engagement with a sigh. But her family wanted her to marry him, and that was the way things were. Not like now, when young people did as they pleased. She sighed and waited for her laptop to snap into life. She brought up the website, took a bite from her cheese and chaat masala sandwich, and typed in her login details. Username, 58 Jaffa Cakes. Password, the road not taken. And what had her parents based their decision on? Did they admire his wit? Were they impressed with his charisma? Or recognise the traits of a kind, caring, selfless nature? No. He had the right job, was the right colour, sported the appropriate amount of facial hair. She was stabbing at the keyboard and had to force herself to stop and breathe out her frustration. Well, now there was no one left to disapprove. She typed out the words, yes, let's meet. And clicked send.
And I don't want to spoil it, but she does meet him. And Noreen, I suppose I listened to that and listening to it, and I'd read it too. There's a real attitude about that story. And it probably says a lot about my misconceptions that I was shocked by the attitude in it. And I shouldn't be shocked, should I?
Well, I mean, what attitude?
That's the whole point
it?
Of this, isn't it?
That to, yes,
to make
exactly.
people like me understand that there is no... There is no simple Muslim woman cliche.
No, exactly. Yeah, and I find it funny that there is that cliche out there because, you know, my experience is just so the reverse of that. Mm. And I use the characters to kind of and the humour to kind of portray all those wonderfully confident, opinionated, at times matriarchal and eccentric Pakistani women that I've encountered my whole life, and it just made the story a lot of fun to write as well.
And it's clearly set you off on a real creative journey. So brilliant. And your involvement has meant a great deal to you. Now, Nafisa, some of the writers have used pseudonyms. Now, why is that?
Yeah, so part of the project was bringing people in as well. So as Muslim women and some were South Asian, we had a range. So we had some who were Middle Eastern as well. When you're coming into groups and talk about love and desire, it's not something that Muslim women with these intersections can just openly talk about. So we had the advantage to say to women that when you're writing fictional pieces, which doesn't have to be based on your life anyway, you have the advantage that you can actually fictionalize your name as well with a pseudonym. And that really created a safe space for these women to broach upon topics that they were actually sometimes quite fearful of talking about. Not that they don't talk about, all women talk about these issues, you know, personal relationships and marriage and, you know, their hopes and aspirations. But it's not something that you will go and talk to a stranger about openly. You know, I wouldn't do that myself. So we had to create these spaces that were comfortable for them. So whether it was fictionalizing your own experiences, or whether it was placing a pseudonym on your own name in the book, or just in the stories that they were creating, actually gave these women the spaces that they needed to explore, you know, their hopes, their fears and their desires, really.
Clearly, Noreen is now going to, well, she is a writer, and she's clearly doing all sorts of writing. But I imagine some women came along, had a real sense of achievement, but perhaps won't do it again. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's interesting because everybody's had a different experience with the group and with the creative writing. Like I said, everyone, you know, there were a lot of people who were apprehensive at the beginning. And for me, it's fantastic because I've seen the women grow, you know, from the first group when, you know, from the first moment they attended to even, you know, just messaging me and saying, you know, can we attend, to actually the end product. And some people won't actually, you know, continue their writing. However, they've grown in confidence, which is fantastic. You know, they've grown in confidence of how they want to approach things. And actually, even if they don't change their behavior, they've actually been able to voice their, you know, their, what they would like to do, how they would like to approach relationships. And sometimes that's hard, especially when you're from diverse communities and you've got potential judgments placed on you.
Or well, even if, did any woman who took part in the workshop face judgment or problems at home as a result of taking part?
I think what we've got to remember as well, you know, just because they're Muslim women or they, you know, they have a cultural group, their fears are not necessarily any different to any other women. So, you know, everybody. Well,
I was going to mention, actually, of course, that when we talked about educating Rita earlier in the book, Rita was also thwarted in her attempts to educate herself by her partner. So it goes right across the board, doesn't it?
Exactly. And this was a fantastic thing of it as well. You know, they did come as Muslim women, but mainly they bonded over their experiences as women. You know, yeah. So some people had mixed relationships outside of their community group. And it was about sharing these experiences, and they bonded over the connections of, you know, the personal relationships, you know, what they want, what they'd hope to have, and maybe how they'd approach things. We do have to remember there are some constraints, cultural constraints or religious expectations that they actually want to embrace. Sure. As well. So it's not necessarily negative, but there's so many multiple layers that they could actually speak to each other on. And this is a good thing about the anthology as well. You know,
absolutely. Sorry to interrupt you, but thank you very much indeed. That was the editor of the anthology, A Match Made in Heaven, Nafisa Ali, and Claire Chambers played a part in that as well. And you also heard from the writer, Noreen Hack. So look out for that name, because I think she's going to do a lot of interesting stuff over the next couple of years. Now, I did say on the radio programme, so I'm going to say it on the podcast as well, that I do... it sounds so pompous, but I do have to announce that I have decided to leave Woman's Hour at the end of the year. But I'm hanging around like a bit of a bad smell until the end of December of 2020. So still much to enjoy. And of course, still so many occasions on which I could get it spectacularly wrong between now and the end of December. So stay with us. I will be getting really maudlin and emotional, but not until December the 29th. And I'm staying on Radio 4 as well. So let that be a warning to you. Thanks to everybody who contacted the programme today. It was really our interviews about miscarriage that resonated with you, as I would expect. It's such a difficult subject, and it must have been awful to go through a miscarriage, particularly during the early months of lockdown. Truly, truly awful, I would imagine. So my heart goes out to anyone who has, or any couple who have been through that over the course of the last couple of months. Sarah emailed to say, I'm listening to this, and in particular the experience of the young woman who miscarried, and it took several weeks of repeated drugs and medication, which failed to bring the pregnancy to an end following that scan with no heartbeat. A close family member had an almost identical experience, but in 2018, long before lockdown. It took over a month before she was finally offered a DNC. It isn't correct, I don't think, for your speaker to use lockdown to explain the limitation of a DNC. It was happening long before, and it was extremely traumatic for my family member. Well, to be fair to Christine, who was our expert, she did acknowledge my point, actually, that it was indeed sometimes very difficult to get a DNC. But thank you very much, Sarah, for that email. And it also resonated, that item, with a listener who will, I think, stay anonymous. But she said, I've just stopped cleaning my house and I'm just here in tears listening to your miscarriage stories. I've had three myself and it's bringing it all back. You never forget them and how distressing it is. We should talk much more about this, as I didn't know how common it was when my first miscarriage happened. And you can feel very alone and desperate to find a reason for you, for it, so you can mitigate it next time. Sadly, I found after lots of tests that sometimes there's just no obvious cause. The information overload feeling is to be expected, and it's easier to have somebody with you. It must have been so hard for these women to go in on their own. I have done it on my own, once with my mum and once with my partner, but it's a horrific piece of news when they scan you and there's nothing there, when previously that little heartbeat was flashing and you still feel pregnant. Yeah, those poor women to be dealing with this during such a difficult time. Sending love to all, says the listener, who goes on to say, now wiping my face and back to the cleaning, taking advantage of my two teenagers returning to school, I am blessed to have the children I do have, but I'll never forget the three I lost. Thank you to that listener for emailing us today. It does mean a huge amount to the programme when people take the time to contact us with their own experiences. Now, next week, amongst other things, I'll be talking to the author Deborah Harding, who's written a memoir about the impact of violence on families. It's called Dancing with the Octopus. We'll talk to her about Botox. Would you? Could you? Should you? I haven't, and I don't think I ever will, but who knows? I reserve the right to change my mind. And later next week, Stephanie Yeboah will talk about her new book, Fatally Ever After, and we'll talk too about how to stop being late. I just can't stand it when people keep me waiting. I mean, I can keep them waiting, obviously, that's an entirely different matter. Join me on Monday, live just after 10, and the highlights of the week on Weekend Woman's Hour tomorrow afternoon, just after 4.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
A new podcast drama series on BBC Sounds. No Place But the Water. The story of a hotel at the end of the world where there's no place else to run to.
But there's just one thing I try not to remember. When I first saw the hotel, when it dived out the water, so big, so strange, I couldn't help looking at its reflection. And when I did that, it was so weird. I think I saw. I mean, I know I didn't. Like an optical illusion. In the water, in the reflection. I saw someone standing there, waiting for us to arrive.
No Place But the Water. A new drama podcast series from BBC Radio 4, set in a future flooded world. When there is no place but the water, where do you go? Subscribe to No Place But the Water on BBC Sounds.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?